And so when I talk about networking, all I'm talking about is being mutually helpful to each other.
Mm.
And I don't know very many successful people who haven't understood that you've got to organize your assistance. And yet I meet so many people who really, it has never come through to them how important. In fact, a man right here in Dallas who was considered for the presidency of one of the companies and was not chosen, had read my book and came over to the house and visited with me. And he said, you know, I'm just now realizing that I have no network of friends to turn to help me. Well, when I have a problem, the first thing I do is say to myself, who solved this problem? Who do I know that's had this problem? I don't care whether it's raising the children, whether it's buying a house, whether it's making an investment, or whether it's, you know, getting a job done. And so it simply is developing a system of people who will be mutually helpful to each other. You might be interested. Last year, my wife, Mary Alice, to whom I've been married for 47 years, and we decided to go on a friendship safari.
Huh.
And so we get in the car, we take 2 weeks, and we simply make a circuitous trip down through Florida and all around, and just see the people that we know. And we didn't set it up in advance so that they'd interfere with our schedule. We'd get about a day in advance. We'd call and say, are you going to be home tomorrow? And they say, yeah, why? Well, how about having dinner with us? How about having lunch with us? One of the most interesting things we've ever done. In fact, we're getting ready to set up another one.
Hmm.
But unless you organize it, unless you plan it, it doesn't happen.
Hmm.
You keep saying, I'd love to see Joe. I'd love to see Mary. But that's all you do.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when I network, it simply means that I'm keeping in contact with the people that I ought to know, that I like to know, that I can be helpful to, and who can be helpful to me.
Talking about contact, that's just meaning keeping in constant communication with one another.
Right.
Helpful? Is it helpful communication?
Well, actually, it starts out being personal communication.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you find people that you grow close to,
mm-hmm.
you find you start out being helpful in a functional way in your job.
Mm-hmm.
And then as you get to know them better, you start to being personally helpful. One of the vice presidents of Mobil Oil and I had a friendship that started in business. In fact, it was just a business relationship. And then one night we went to Las Vegas attending a convention where I was speaking. And it was for his company. And we had dinner together. And he said, let's take a walk. And we got out and took a walk. And I realized that he was beginning to talk personally.
Hmm.
He began to talk about his family, his children, his own life. And then I realized we were coming into a personal relationship. And then one night in New York, he asked me to have dinner with him, and he brought his family. And I realized that the family was now being included. And so we go to their home. They come to our home. In fact, last month we had dinner with them. And I'm helpful to him. He's helpful to me. Incidentally, he called me the other day, and he said, I bought your book, and then I went back and bought 12 more and sent them to all my family.
Oh, my God.
And I want them to read it. And I was tremendously complimented that he did that. But that's the helpful type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think you can push yourself on people. I'm offended by people who try to get too close to me too soon. I kind of feel like they're, you know, pushy, or they're trying to get, you know, things out of me that I don't want to give.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you normally start in a business or social or church relationship on just an acquaintance basis. And then as you work well on that basis, then you start to move on a personal basis and then on a family basis. And I think ultimately you move into a spiritual basis.
Hmm.
And that may take an awful long time.
Hmm.
I am not one to grab somebody's lapel and talk to him about something as personal as his is his spiritual light. I think if there's something in me that inspires his confidence that he wants to talk to me, then I feel that the spiritual atmosphere is better. Mm-hmm. That if I aggressively grab him, and I don't ask anybody how much money they got in the bank. and I think maybe the spirit is even more personal than the financial.
Huh. That is really something else. In your book, you, let me see if I can get to the chapter in there. Oh, well, I may not be able to get to it right away, because I just enjoyed this so much. You talked about the people in your network.
Yes.
Okay, and you've devoted one whole chapter to it and eight sub-chapters.
Right.
One of those, which I thought was very, very good, was the sub-chapter on your heroes.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, actually, I've said to young people, tell me who your heroes are and I'll tell you what your values are.
Yeah.
Because our heroes establish our values. I was in New York and was talking to a young president of a billion-dollar company. And he had been anxious to meet a financier whom I knew. And he had asked me to have the three of us for lunch, and so it did. And this financier is a Jewish philosopher as well as an international financier.
Hmm.
And the first question he asked this young president, who are your heroes?
Hmm.
And this young man named a very brash general and an egomaniac industrialist.
Oh, my word.
And it's very interesting that the conversation didn't go nearly as long as I expected. It was a short lunch. And after the lunch, I asked my friend, the Jewish philosopher, financier, I said, what's your impression? He said, oh, what a shame to turn a corporation that big over to such an immature young man.
Mm.
And he had just seen from his heroes that his value structure wasn't good. Whoever a nation makes as their heroes says what the nation values. And I think you have to be very careful today, particularly with young people. We have a great tendency to make celebrities our heroes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And celebrities come and go. And generally, we see a side of them that's not totally them. We see a dressed-up side. We see a puff side, a promotional side. And we're in a period when a lot of the current heroes are having the clay in their feet shown. Their personal servants are writing, you know, books about them, and stories are coming out about them. So I think you have to be careful not to pick your heroes too quickly. Mm-hmm. I think it's better to pick your heroes from the past, because when you pick them from the past, you have had a chance to really know them. The interesting thing about the Bible, in the heroes they list, they always tell their weaknesses. And this keeps you from being able to dethrone them. I mean, David, you know, murderer, adulterer, Peter, you know, with his problems, and Paul with his. But the Bible is very frank to say these men are worthy of being your heroes, but they were human.
Right.
And so you don't ever become disillusioned.
That's the key, though, isn't it?
Oh.
Where people go ahead and they put all their heroes up on a pedestal, and they're making them more than human.
Oh, yes. The heroes, to me, simply personify your value structure.
Mm-hmm.
If you were to ask me who my heroes are, I wouldn't tell you because you'd know too much about me. But I would certainly tell you one, Leonardo da Vinci. And yet, if you'll notice that, as I remember, there are only about 20 finished works of Leonardo da Vinci.
Hmm.
I think that most people consider that he was probably the greatest mind that the civilization has ever produced. And the reason he's my hero is because he thought in principles. See, so many of the things he thought about, there was no way to work out. There was no way to work out a submarine or an airplane or anything like that because of metallurgy, because of technological advancement had not come. But he understood the principles upon which the world operated.
Mm-hmm.
And it was from these principles that he could see how life could be.
Yeah.
And he was very relaxed toward life. He was not a man who was all strung out and was all nervous about life. He seemed to have some sense that God was probably running the place and he wasn't. And I see so many people that literally you think that they believe that God's going to take a vacation, going to call on them to run the place, and they've got to be ready.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's just a marvelous quality about being able to relax and say, the world's been here a long time, God's in charge of it, I don't have to run it myself, I can just enjoy it. I think the Quakers have a marvelous philosophy here when they talk about the quiet center of life. Mm-hmm. And they're not talking about loafing. They're talking about living with a quiet center to your life, a poise. And I think Leonardo da Vinci did that.
Hmm.
Did you know, Paul, you'd be interested in this because you have that kind of intellectual curiosity. Leonardo da Vinci spent 2 years. Now, he has the greatest artistic talent and the greatest mind the world's ever produced. He spent 2 years making a suit of mail for a lizard that made him look like a dragon. You know, you've got to be relaxed about life, you know, to do that. I could just see him, you know, trying that on that little lizard and laughing. And, you know, he wasn't worrying about what history was going to say about him.
Yeah, that's true. And yet look at what history has said about him.
Oh, it's said so much.
Yeah. And it's all been, you know, if it were on a report card, it'd be A+.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
He was a man of great, great understanding, talent. Yeah, he had poise. Those were the kind of things that make him a hero for me.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, your heroes and your models are different. See, you mentioned there, let me see if I can recount them. You have your heroes who set your values. You have your models who set your skills.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have your mentors
mm-hmm.
who help you with your development. And then you have your peers who present you with the challenges of pressure, the peer pressure. And then you have your enemies, who are very interesting. Enemies do some wonderful things for you. And then you have then you have friends. Of course, sometimes you have friends that remove any need for enemies. But you have your friends, and then you have your family, and then you have yourself. And you are the most important person in that network. Because you are fully responsible for what happens to you. Your own development, your own sense of responsibility, your own acceptance of your talents, your gifts, and the development of them. And I think as you handle those, you create respect among the other group.
Hmm. Among those that you just mentioned.
You set up an environment.
Yeah.
All except your heroes. Most of your heroes are dead.
Well, the one word, you know, that keeps on coming to my mind as you are mentioning all this is choice. They have to go ahead and choose to do these things. They have to go ahead and choose.
I believe that when, you know, Dr. Barbara Brown, who is doing so much in biofeedback research, there's so much in going on in psychology with Norman Cousins in medicine and so forth. But I believe that when they finally come down to the essence of man, they're going to find that man is basically a will.
Hmm.
And that will chooses. I think God gives us this, and this is probably the greatest gift as humans we've ever received, is the option to choose. And yet so many people, because choosing sometimes is difficult. There's pressure in it.
Oh, yeah.
There's chance of making mistakes. And a lot of people just, rather than make a decision, will let circumstances make the decision, or they'll let other people make the decision. And they think they escape their responsibility. We don't. The marvelous thing about being a human, a fully alive, awake human, is that we have the opportunity to choose.
Name of the game.
Right.
Yeah. There was a question that I happened to think of when we were talking here. And, you know, for the life of me, I got so wrapped up in what you were saying.
You're very kind.
I forgot. I'm being honest.
But now, listen, I'm the one that's supposed to be old enough to be into senility, not you. You're just a young, vital person.
Well, okay, I'll take that. I appreciate that. That's a great compliment, too. Thank you. Boy, I wish I could remember what it was, and I can't. Ugh. That is embarrassing to go ahead and talk about that and then get so enraptured with what your guest is trying to say that you almost lose all sense of time. You lose the train of thought that you wanted to go ahead and get to that person.
You know, this is what we really ought to do more of. We're finding and we're doing some things with people on just informal but serious conversation.
Yeah.
You know, we all get so tired of cocktail parties and social events. And, you know, you go and you see people who've had marvelous experiences, people who are sophisticated, they're educated, they have great things to say, and they're standing around saying absolutely nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
In fact, you would embarrass somebody to say something that made sense. You know, our conversation is sort of choreographed like dancing. You know, you don't step on my feelings. You don't speak of religion. You don't talk about politics. I was interested in Bill Buckley talking to Malcolm Muggeridge.
Oh,
and Buckley was saying how he would be embarrassed to talk about spiritual things and among his social group. And Muggeridge said, what else is there worth talking about? And here you've got two very sophisticated men, two very intelligent men.
Very, yeah.
And one of them saying he'd be afraid to talk spiritually. The other one saying, what else is there to talk? I think, actually, you ought to be willing to talk about anything. But we are finding great fun. We're having groups now who just come to the house, and we sit around, and we just talk about whatever we want to talk about. We don't have any list, any agenda. And so somebody opens up on a subject, and it moves very freely anywhere. Oh, what stimulation.
That's what you were talking about.
Yeah, great evenings.
Before,
yeah.
Before we started even taping. Was that you have groups
right.
that come. Explain that a little bit, because I find that fascinating, and I know some people...
Well, I got to thinking about it in the sense of business, so I put out an invitation to 25, what we call CEOs, chief executive officers, to meet down at the Woodlands, which is an excellent executive retreat, mm-hmm. for Thursday night, Friday, and Saturday till noon, with no agenda, no discussion leaders, no nothing, except... Here were 23 men out of the 25 who accepted, which meant they had to shove their schedule around. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know each other. And here they came down there. They were very uptight about the fact there was no agenda. I had some to call me and say, you know, how can I prepare for this? I said, you're alive, aren't you? I mean, you've got your wits about you. You're prepared to sit and talk with friends. And so we sat in a big oblong circle. Had just a pot of coffee, a pitcher of water, a blackboard, or somebody wanted to write something on the blackboard. And we sat there for that whole time. And we would talk till 2 o'clock in the morning. People didn't want to go home when the end came. And the wonderful thing is there are people who are still today, you know, corresponding, calling, talking to each other. In fact, we have another situation that's this part of networking. We have what we call a First Thought Club, which I just listed 25 men whom I consider to be interesting men. And I asked them if they'd be willing to circulate a thought each month. Hmm. Now, all of us don't hit it every month, but there's enough goes on that we've been doing this for years. And some of the most interesting memos are circulated among these fellows. If they read something that's unusual, or they write something that's unusual, or something that's funny... And these 20, and many of them have never met. And now they're putting pressure on, you know, hey, I've been reading this fellow's stuff, you know, for 5 years. Dr. James Cain, you know, who was President Johnson's doctor at Mayo. He's one of them. I can name you a whole group of people. And he writes some marvelous things. And everybody says, you know, I want to meet him. And so we're going to have to get together and... one of our men, Jack Turpin, who's CEO of Hallmark Electronic. Jack is one of the group, and so he's invited them to come down to his place in New Braunfels. And the wives say, you're not going without us. And
oh boy.
So we're looking forward. I don't know when it'll happen, but we're looking forward. But this kind of thing ought to be multiplied.
Ought to be done more.
Oh.
Yeah.
It ought to be. And it can be.
Goodness. In your book... At the end of the chapters, you have These little words of wisdom.
One-liners.
I love them.
Do you?
Did you get them? Now, I should go ahead and say this, that the way that I ran across Fred Smith was through Leadership Magazine for pastors out there, even for seminary students who subscribe to it. They know who I'm talking about because this is the same gentleman that's writing the columns. Still is, right?
Yes.
Okay, good. Now, I didn't know because I've been not getting a copy of Leadership for about a year. But you always have these little witticisms in there that just drive me up the wall. They're, they're truisms. That's the kicker.
Yeah, well, I think that I think my business experience has taught me to somewhat go for the essence of things. Mm-hmm. I find that if you can try to reduce things to a very simple point, you probably understand it. You remember what Einstein said about God? He said, whatever God does, he does in its simplest form. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean it is always simple, but it's the simplest it can be. Mm-hmm. And I've always wanted to get concepts and find a way to put them into some kind of short sentence. My friend Bob Shuler was on, Good Morning America this morning, I believe, mm-hmm. with Dave Hartman. And I noticed when he was there with his daughter Carol, who had lost a leg, he said, she turned her scars into stars.
Wow.
Well, you know, there's something nice about that. You can carry that with you. I like to have an idea with a handle, which means words that you can carry. And so you carry a concept. And I've written most of these are my own, and I just tucked them in at the end of the chapter, and I was in a little church. We have a place up in East Texas, and on Sunday I went to a little chapel up there, and a former alcoholic came around to me, and he showed me a list of these that he'd taken out of the book, and he got up to take the offering in the little chapel, and he read a couple of them, and he promised that he was going to do this each Sunday, you know. And I think they do appeal to people because they appeal to me. If I can get a lot, and this is what Proverbs is. Mm-hmm. Proverbs is simply taking a lot of thought and squeezing it down, putting in the essence.
Yeah, sometimes in one sentence.
Yeah, right.
You know.
Sometimes a balancing sentence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.